Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Let's have a little fun. Ladies and gentlemen, our national anthem.
What a frisbee. A frisbee's fun. It's a flying saucer that you command. Watch.
It is an American theme, that Frisbee commercial. Maybe more relevant than our real anthem because it's more about the American dream. The commercials of the 20th century American toy company, Wham-O. We're going to talk later this hour about Wham-O's culture with someone who used to work there. How the maker of Frisbees and the Super Ball and the Slip and Slide and the Magic Window and the Air Blaster is all about the entrepreneurial dreams that are still driving the tech revolution today. Also, how the anti-vaccination movement may have left children and adults vulnerable to some diseases we thought we had conquered. But we begin with the death announced officially yesterday of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, reminding us of one of this country's most important alliances, a relationship that predates NATO and even the creation of the State of Israel.
One of the most colorful visits to the presidential cruiser was that of the ruler of Saudi Arabia, King Ibn Saud.
To the White House comes Crown Prince Faisal of Saudi Arabia at his own request to see President Eisenhower.
President Kennedy pays a courtesy call on the leader of the oil-rich country to wish him a speedy recovery.
I took this action to assist the Saudi Arabian government.
President Bush and Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah holding hands as they stroll.
I want to welcome His Majesty, King Abdullah, to the White House.
Saudi Arabia and the United States, uneasy rivals in the oil business, uneasy partners in Middle East politics. The Saudi royal court announced that King Abdullah died at age 90 today after being admitted to a hospital for a lung infection on December 31st. Abdullah's brother, Crown Prince Salman, announced that he had assumed the throne in a smooth transition of power, a transition that has been coming for some time, according to former U.S. Ambassador James Smith.
King Abdullah has been ill for several years. I will tell you that when I arrived in 2009, people were predicting his ill health 5 years ago. He's outlived two crown princes, and he's been a man of very solid strength. So we knew it was inevitable. Having said that, the Saudi bureaucracy proceeded with him at the helm. And I think if you look at the duties that Crown Prince, now King Salman, has picked up over the last year or two, then it's pretty clear that the Saudis had a transition plan in mind. And for all of those that feared instability as a byproduct of secession were mistaken.
And this is very much a stay-the-course message, King Salman.
I think it's a stay-the-course message on a trajectory of modernization. You have to understand that this is a very, very conservative society, and you've got about half the population that thinks in terms of a very conservative and going back to the days of the Prophet Muhammad, if you will, and half the population that's looking for modernization and saying that the modernization is painfully slow. So the king has to balance these, and what King Abdullah did so effectively over the last 20 years is balance those constituencies always in a direction of modernization.
But there is another cleavage in Saudi Arabia, and Abdullah has managed to paper over that. But I'm wondering how sustainable the balance is between the sort of proliferating royal family within the bureaucracy and everyone else in Saudi Arabia. The idea that the royal family is perceived as being entitled and on some level a hindrance to real modernization, and that that fuels a kind of instability moving ahead.
It's not there yet, John. Most Saudis are comfortable with the government as it is. Certainly, there has been, we saw this in 2011 with the Arab Spring, voices that wanted to control corruption, that wanted to make sure that monies were flowing to people who are needed, that money was used for development. You hear those kinds of things, but you rarely hear any sense of dissatisfaction with the structure of the government. So, yeah, you have a royal family that's expanding, but the reality of that is there are probably only a very limited number of senior princes that impact the government in a very strong way. So it's a much more complex bureaucracy in society than this binary discussion of the royal family and everybody else.
Ambassador James Smith, before we go, someone today summed up the crisis facing King Salman in Saudi Arabia right now in four words: oil prices, Yemen, Iran. How would you assess that?
Well, that's a start. I think Saudi Arabia is facing a number of crises that go well beyond all of those. If you look at the external threat, their number one concern is Iran. There's no question about that. And number two is to the south and what's going on in Yemen and their longstanding conflict with the Houthis. Number three, and not far behind, is the border to the north with Daesh, or ISIS, as some people call it, and those fighters coming back home, as they did after Afghanistan. So they've got this challenge internally. Yeah, you have the challenge of revenues, although this is not going to play out in a big way in Saudi Arabia for some years because they've done a very credible job of building reserves. So they'll be able to ride out oil prices depressed for some time. The real challenge in the midterm, John, is that we have a generation of Saudis, all who have been able to go off to university through the King Abdullah Scholarship Program. It is a program that rivals the GI Bill in terms of its potential impact on that country. If the Saudis are not able to move away from a state-run economy into one that empowers entrepreneurship, small and medium enterprises, and allows for job creation in the private sector, then you're going to have a generation of young people coming home with advanced degrees, unable to find a job, and that's where the frustration will begin in this generation.
Ambassador James Smith, former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 2009 to 2013, thanks so much for joining us.
John, good to be with you.
Let's expand on some of the issues raised by the ambassador with Robert Wirth, longtime foreign correspondent for the New York Times and current fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Robert.
Thank you.
So when King Abdullah took office, was elevated to king, it was a very different Middle East world, and particularly a world in the Gulf. Now you've really got a rivalry with Iran and this instability in Yemen right on the border. What do you make of all that and how that's going to affect Salman, King Salman's early going here?
Well, the immediate threat is going to be Yemen. The Houthis have been there for some time, and it's interesting that you noted when King Abdullah came to power, they were just really being noticed for the first time. They were formed in the late 90s, mid-90s, but the first war they fought with the Yemeni state was 2004. At the time, they were this small group in a remote part of Yemen. Now they really control the state. And as of yesterday, there is, the president has stepped down. There's no cabinet, no vice president. It's a completely rudderless country. And you have the Houthis who are at war with al-Qaeda and also at war with the remnants of the country's biggest Sunni party, the equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood. So what's going to happen there is completely unclear. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia has already pulled out most of its aid to Yemen. And Saudi Arabia was the lifeline economically for Yemen because its economy has been a basket case for some time. The trouble, as I see it, is that the transition, granted, is fairly smooth, but there's more to it than just Salman ascending to the throne. His royal court has to be managed. It's not clear whether he'll maintain the same person who really ran the kingdom day to day for King Abdullah, whose name is Khalid Tawajiri, or whether he'll select someone else. And in the meantime, you have a very, very, very pressing situation to the south, and the Saudis have always been the most important external partner for Yemen. So I think they're really going to have to move faster than they usually move on that one.
One more thing on Yemen. Are the Houthis Iranian proxies, or is it too early to say at this point?
I don't think it's fair to call them Iranian proxies. The Houthis modeled themselves heavily on Hezbollah, but not because Hezbollah was giving them any advice. They just looked out and said, look, here's an insurgent movement that has been very successful, and we should take some lessons from them. The Houthis were accused for many years of being Iranian proxies at a time when it certainly was not true. There was very little connection at all with Iran at that time. People make the connection naturally because the Houthis are Zaydis, and Zaydism is a branch of Shiite Islam. But doctrinally, it's actually very far from the mainstream Shiite Islam that's practiced in Iran. However, in recent years, there have been links formed. The Iranians have given some weapons, money, and so forth to the Houthis, even though the Houthis scarcely needed it. They had a lot of weapons of their own, and they proved themselves to be excellent fighters. However, the assistance has expanded quite a bit since 2011, when things became a lot more chaotic in Yemen after the uprising. And now the extent of Iranian Houthi cooperation is really unclear. I think you could certainly say the Houthis are definitely they're clearly a Yemeni phenomenon. They originated there. Their goals and leadership are unmistakably Yemeni. They're not anywhere near as close to Iran as, for instance, Hezbollah is.
Right, right. Before we go, one other issue. Is this an opportunity for religious forces in Saudi Arabia to make some play politically? It's always been in the background.
I don't think so. The Saudis have been involved in all kinds of ways in Yemen for a long, long time. They dispersed regular payments to all kinds of tribal sheikhs and political figures. And this was done in a very undisciplined, corrupt way where it wasn't clear what was to be given in exchange. Many people in Yemen regard the Saudis just as this sort of big piggy bank and openly mocked them for it. The Saudis, in other words, have the power of the checkbook, but it's not clear what other power they have. Mm-hmm. The Houthis arose in part as a rebellion against Wahhabi influence coming from Saudi Arabia.
Robert Wirth is a contributor to our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Later this hour, a romp through Toyland, a very special Toyland.
I'll tell you, my basement, just between us,
okay,
is like a museum of the bizarre toy. My grandkids just love coming here.
Let's go there immediately. That's Dan Roddick, former sports marketing director for Wham-O, the company that brought us Super Bowls, Silly String, and Frisbees. From Banks, Oregon, Ultimate Frisbee was my favorite sport through my teen years. Some summers, my family, friends, and I would play up to three times a week. Still love to throw around a nice 175-gram Discraft Ultrastar, the best disc on the market. In San Antonio, growing up on the beaches of West Coast Florida, I have many fun times spent throwing the Frisbee with friends while skipping classes and drinking beer. Other toy favorites? From Sukasuna, New Jersey, Barbies. I love Barbies and playing tennis against the house. I used to put my folks outside and pretend they were going across a wilderness.
This is Nikki from Oakland, California. My trike first, and then my bicycle were my favorite toys. I was a younger sibling, so taking off on a wheeled conveyance of my own represented like being a big kid. I love to soar along the byways of an ever-expanding universe. And at 54, I still love it.
Then you'd love the Wham-O wheelie attachment for your bike. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be a part of our later in the hour conversation. Let me tell you about this great new ride at California's Disneyland. You stand in line, spend the day in crowds of kids, then you go home and your skin breaks out in little red spots. Yes, the big wow at the oldest Disney theme park is measles these days. A measles outbreak to the park has infected dozens of Disneyland visitors. Joining us is Dr. Shruti Gohil, who's Associate Medical Director for Epidemiology and Infection Prevention at the University of California Irvine Medical Center. Doctor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
So I have one sort of confusion here. I'm surprised that Disneyland would be a vector for measles since so many tourists go there, not so much locals. How does this work?
Well, it really has to do with the number of people that you see in any one place congregated together. And Disneyland sure is a very large sort of congregation, so to speak. Every day you see hundreds of thousands of people.
And so what have you noticed in terms of infection rates, and how do you gauge whether it's just isolated cases versus a real pattern?
Well, you know, this is unusual. You know, in all the years that Disneyland has been running, this is the first, you know, sort of measles outbreak that we have seen. So, you know, obviously it's not the most common thing. It really has to do with the population that happens to be going there and how many of the people are foreign tourists who have not been immunized against measles or who might be carrying measles, because measles is still quite active in other parts of the world. And then a combination of that and the number of people who are unvaccinated, who are susceptible to acquiring measles. If your vaccination rates are high, then you're more likely to have a controlled situation in which outbreaks are less likely.
Is Southern California a pocket of unvaccinated young people?
Well, you know, California, like many other states in the nation, has in place personal belief exemptions and other types of policies that have been in effect for about a decade that allow parents to opt out vaccinations despite having access to public schools. And so California, I wouldn't say is unique in the way that that type of legislation has borne out. But yes, we have pockets of areas, particularly in the coastal areas, particularly in affluent areas, where parents are more likely to use that personal belief exemption and opt out of vaccines.
What is the danger? Remind us, since it's been so long that measles was a problem. I remember the issue of German measles and birth defects, but what is the danger of measles as an infection?
Sure. You know, it's a very, very important question. We're victims of our own success. It's been a wonderful advance that vaccines have blanketed our country enough to where we see minimal not communicable diseases in the era that we used to see them. Back, you know, if you dial back to the late 50s or early 60s, people used to die of measles, right? So one out of every 20 children with measles gets pneumonia. One out of every child who gets measles, out of 1,000 children who get measles, will develop encephalitis. Encephalitis was a very prominent cause of developmental disability in that era. And one out of every child who gets measles will die from measles. Now, if you take that, we don't have to dial back too far. If you take it globally, 122,000 people die of measles every year. That's a pretty big number.
And in terms of other diseases besides measles, is there a threat of polio? Is there a threat of some of the other diseases which have an even higher visibility?
Sure, absolutely. Other parts of the country, other parts of the world, we do have poor vaccination rates. That has to do with a combination of many things, including political instability and poverty and other issues like belief patterns about vaccines. And so we do see outbreaks of both measles and polio and other types of illnesses. It's not unique to measles, but measles is far more contagious. It has a transmission rate that's quite high. 90% of susceptible people will become ill with measles. So then measles outbreaks often tend to be higher in number.
All right. Before we go, you have to deal with parents, I suspect, and lots of doctors do. What's your advice on pitching parents with the idea that whatever their belief pattern is, they should get immunized? And have you done that yourself?
Yeah. You know, I do. I understand patients and parents and why there's hesitation, because many of the things that are available on the internet and other reading type of material really makes the vaccination issue problematic, particularly in light of the fact that doctors don't often have time to communicate with patients. And I try to remind our patients that we both want the same thing for the children. And if, again, you look back, we have not really understood how bad these types of communicable diseases can be in our era. And I try to remind them of these statistics. And often parents, once they realize what the complications can be, and if you weigh the risk and benefit, the risks of the vaccine causing complications and those numbers against the numbers of susceptibility if you were to actually acquire measles, then it far weighs heavily on the side of benefit to taking the vaccine.
And does that work? Does that convince them?
Yes. More often than not, I have been successful with that.
All right, Dr. Shruti Gohil is Associate Medical Director for Epidemiology and Infection Prevention at UC Irvine Medical Center. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Talking about measles and a measles outbreak at Disneyland, which underscores the unvaccinated population in Southern California and other places around the United States.
He's the man with all the toys.
Speaking of California and California culture, who hasn't seen Frisbees on the beach? What was your favorite toy growing up? We're going to be talking with a former marketing director of Wham-O, my favorite toy company, certainly. From Alpharetta, Georgia, Big Wheel. What could beat a big plastic tricycle with a handbrake on the rear wheel? The skids and spins were thrilling.
Hi, it's Wendy Sherman from New York City. This will show my age, but my favorite toy were roller skates that you had to put on with a key. They let me fly down the sidewalks of Manhattan.
Hi, Tom Colling from Dallas. Our favorite toys were Hot Wheels. My brother and I both loved running the cars on the tracks with the loops, and they were the best toys ever.
Oh, I had so many Hot Wheels. And you know, if you sucked those into the vacuum cleaner, you'd have to buy a new vacuum cleaner. Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. All one word, at The Takeaway.
He's the man with all the toys.
A story now about the American dream.
The Firetron Formula Super Ball and Super Elastic Bubble Plastic. Plastic bubbles from a tube.
This is absolutely one of those only in America stories.
The great strength of Monster Magnet is now in your hands.
It embraces the inventive mythology of Thomas Edison, the culture of rock and roll.
Now you can do it. A real wheelie with Wheelie Bar.
California beach, sandlot playgrounds, and the entrepreneurial spirit of Steve Jobs.
Sold everywhere by Wham-O.
Wham-O from Wham-O.
Made by Wham-O.
Wham-O.
Its name? Well, who but an American can come up with Wham-O? A company that since 1948 has revolutionized the toy industry, helped create the X Games freestyle movement, and has always been a pioneer in the development of intellectual property, like the slip and slide, the hula hoop, the Super Bowl, and of course, the flying disc toy Frisbee.
Here comes the Shoop Shoop Hula Hoop and the Frisbee family of flying fun. Now, seven different Frisbees. Seven ways to discover the wonderful world of Frisbee flight. Frisbee, everybody's idea of a good time.
Depending on who you talk to, Frisbee is an invention of Yale students who snacked on Frisbee pies up in Connecticut and tossed the empty tins around, or it's the genius of inventor and former POW Walter Morrison, who fashioned butyl stearate plastic into the 1951 Pluto platter. And more than 200 million plastic Frisbees later, here we are. And Frisbee is just one of the technological and marketing successes of Wham-O. Dan Roddick is former director of sports promotions for Wham-O. Welcome.
Hello.
What's it like working for Wham-O?
It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it was a zany operation. I mean, really something that I'm not sure any companies could possibly pull off these days. They were the inventor's friend.
And in many ways, it reminds me of the spirit of Apple, of some of the high-tech companies, which are very nerdy and brainy, but still that spirit of, hey, that's cool, is all Wham-O.
It really was. And I think, especially in the very early going, Bud and Rich, the real powers behind the company, were open to any sort of idea. And people literally walked in the door, sat down and said, hey, you know, I think I've got a really great idea. Here's a piece of rubber that bounces high. What can we make out of it? And they would run right from that day with something that may have only lasted a season, but it was just fun to see what they could do with it.
So Spud and Rich were the Jobs and Wozniak of Wham-O.
Exactly.
So it was some of the ideas, and we played some of them at the top. I mean, there's the slip and slide, of course, which had some longevity. Frisbee, of course, is the, you know, it will be around forever. But there are also weird things like that weird little Mr. Wiggle that you put on the hose, and it just sort of wiggles around using the power of the water moving up. The Super Bowl, of course. Any favorites of yours?
Wow. when you look through the litany of things, one of the things that really caught my attention during those years was the magic window.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
I had a huge one. It was probably 3 foot on a side, and it would spin on the wall. And that was just a good example of the kinds of things that from nowhere they would come up with an idea that really caught people's imagination.
Let's give people a picture of the magic window. It's a piece of clear plastic, two pieces of clear plastic, like Saran wrap, but a little stronger. And inside of it is some sort of liquid, I think, and this weird black iron filings stuff that moves around in weird patterns.
Well, it's hard to say what was actually in there. Most of the things had some secret component, like in the Super Bowl was Zectron, which I don't think anyone actually knew what it was.
That was one of the features of WAMO. There was always some sort of mysterious scientific part of what made it fun.
And in a lot of ways, that was the real essential key and still is to the Frisbee. And that is when a person first sees it fly, and that's not easy to find these days, but people are under the impression that there is something absolutely mystical going on in its flight. And they're right.
Physicists, of course, would say, no, it's just the Bernoulli principle or the Bernoulli principle, right?
You know, I don't think they really truly know still why it flies as well as it does.
What was it like marketing the Frisbee in Boomerang, Australia? I would have figured they would say, hey, mate, we got those already.
Well, we did get a lot of requests to make it come back to us. And fortunately, that's one of the things that the Frisbee also does. But the reaction that we had there, as I say, was humbling to us. When we showed it to people, it was instant love. And that really continued. Every time I ever did a trade show for WAMO, when people turned the corner and walked down toward our booth, it never failed that they had a smile on their face. And when they got there, they had some wonderful story about how the Frisbee was part of their family life and how much they loved it.
Before we go, you mentioned the magic window. The Frisbee, of course, we're all in love. Do you have any sort of stuff kicking around your house that you show the grandkids? Or, you know, I don't even know if you have grandkids, but you must have some wacky, wonderful WAMO stuff.
I'll tell you, my basement, just between us,
okay,
is like a museum of the bizarre toy. My grandkids just love coming here.
Can I come over?
Absolutely.
Dan Roddick, thanks so much. That's an invitation. I'll take you up on that in Pasadena, California. Dan, of course, is the former director of sports promotions for WAMO. Only on this show, the Museum of the Bizarre Toy. What is your favorite toy? Did WAMO define your childhood summers like it did mine? Esther from Jacksonville, Florida says,
my favorite American summer icon had to very simply be my home's lawn sprinkler system. It instantly recreated my lawn into a magnificent water park during the humid, sweltering heat of the South Florida summer.
This is John Bauer. I'm calling from Shelby, North Carolina. Ultimate Frisbee was one of my favorite sports throughout my teen years. There were summers where my family and friends and I would sometimes play between 3 and 4 times a week. And it's still really fun activity for me and my friends to go out, take 175-gram Discraft Ultra Star, the best disc on the market, and just play catch on a beautiful day. So Frisbees have been a really big part of my life.
Ultimate Frisbee, Ultimate Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE. A living spoken language needs at least two people, one to talk and the other to talk back. That's Charlie Mangula from Northern Australia speaking Amerindoc. He's the only one left in the world who can. And he is speaking to someone in the spirit world. But when Charlie himself goes off to the spirit world, there will only be this recording. This is the contemporary fate of a third of the more than 6,000 languages humans speak. It's estimated that fully half of them may be extinct in the next 50 years, with humanity evolving into a community of commerce requiring a small set of easily translatable languages. A new PBS documentary, Language Matters, premiering January 25th, takes a look at what the world stands to lose in this century. The documentary is hosted by poet Bob Holman. It's directed by David Gruben. Holman says the predicament of the Amerindoc language is where the story begins.
You're talking about a very unusual situation in Aboriginal Australia. Charlie Mangulda is the last speaker of Amerindoc. And we love to start our film Language Matters with him, because when you talk about a language dying and all of a sudden you're looking at a person who, when he forgets a word, there's nobody he can ask what that word is. It's gone. When that language is gone, it's gone forever. Now, how has that language lasted tens of thousands of years is another question. And that the answer to that is partly in the way that he is a song man, which is the English word for the poet in the Aboriginal peoples. They keep their language alive in various forms. While we were busy in making inventions, they were busy working on their languages. And one of them is a spirit language that we don't know how to translate. All we know is that he's talking to his ancestors in a very special way. It's part of the way the language has survived.
Are these oral traditions, alphabetic traditions in most cases? You know, a lot of people say that the internet is revitalizing an oral tradition, but these are more sophisticated than emoticons, right?
They are oral traditions. In fact, the languages that are dying are pretty much oral languages. That is, the only writing that they've done has been brought to them with orthographies from the linguists. But in a way, the digital consciousness is a kind of synthesis of orality and literacy. And now for the first time, we are able to actually record these languages, oral languages, in a way that gives them their fullness with technology that's available to people for cameras and film. But at the same time, this is the technology that's part of the reason why these languages are dying out so fast right now.
And these are very sophisticated languages. Because they're oral doesn't mean that they're not sophisticated. They're filled with profound myths and stories. They just happen to be oral.
Do the people who are in the communities of these languages, do they recognize the threat? Do they feel the threat? Are they yearning to join the rest of the world? How does it work? And I suspect it varies.
Yeah, that's what's complicated here, because we can understand why people who speak an endangered language want to join the dominant language. It's, as one person says in our film, it's for our babies. We want them to succeed. On the other hand, there are people in these cultures that are so proud of their language and so firm about it that they are struggling, like in Hawaii, to preserve the language with schools in which only Hawaiian is spoken, things like that.
But, you know, really, John, the answer to this crisis is simpler than solving the physical ecology of the planet, and that is bilinguality or multilinguality. You know, there's no reason why you can't learn your mother tongue at home and speak, and then when you leave the home, you'll be inundated with the bully language. Turn on the television, you're going to have the English coming at you. Walk outside and you'll see all the English signs. But it's just that people have felt that in order to assimilate, they have to leave their whole identity behind. And what's happened now is that it's reached such a pitch that we're losing languages that are actually treasures of humanity. They're systems of consciousness that connect us to the planet in a way that is unique. And to lose one is really to lose something.
Well spoken in English. Let's get personal here. What kind of a person are you? Are you trapped pretty much in the English language as I am from birth, or are you multilingual? Do you have different tongues, both of you?
My French, my Spanish, not enough for me to be able to say I see the world through French and Spanish. I think I can understand something about how the French and Spanish speakers have a different feel for things, because I know something about the languages, but I don't see the world that way.
And you?
And, I've learned the Romance languages enough to get along, and wherever I have gone in studying these languages, I've I've picked up enough to be able to have a conversation. But it's Welsh that I've been studying. Welsh is the only language that's been on the endangered list and then come off. And, of course, as a poet, the Welsh poetry has also drawn me to it.
Dwi am fynd â thi i Far Rockaway, Far Rockaway. Mae enw'r lle yn gitar yn fy mhen, yn gor o rhythmau haf a llanw'r môr. Yn sgwrs cariadon dros goffi cry ar ôl taith drwy'r nos mewn pick-up di.
In fact, it's some of the techniques in Welsh poetry that have helped keep that language alive all these thousands of years.
What yearnings about meanings, about modes of expression in some of these languages that have no analog in English did you discover in your production of this film?
I would say that in Welsh, for example, that the cynhanaeth that I was referring to before, this a type of a poetic device called, in English maybe best, a consonant chime, where you hear the hardness of the consonants in a sort of mirrored form in the poem. We hear it when we listen to Dylan Thomas in English. You say, why is that sounding so great? Well, actually, he's using the devices of Welsh poetry he's bringing to us in English.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Now, how does that make you feel different? All I can say is you go down to the pub in any town in Wales and start hearing that language, those consonants chime, it's a different experience.
So is your mission a call for preservation, a kind of, wilderness preserve a notion in this film, or is it more just experience this? This is still alive. It's vital. Remember this still exists.
The idea of preserving is not quite it, John. It's because languages are a living thing, and they've got to get out there in the world and change. You've got to be able to use them and joke in them and whisper in your lover's ear with them. And
because language is more than communication. It's more than just these words that we're using. It is all about identity and, finally, culture, and it's a whole vision of the world. And you're going to lose a way of seeing the world when you lose language.
That's Bob Holman, poet, and director Dave Grubin on their new PBS documentary, Language Matters, which premieres January 25th. So languages left to languish. How about in your toy box? Favorite childhood toy preserved in memory, at least?
Hi, this is Holly from Portland, Oregon. As a military brat, my siblings and I spent extraordinary amounts of time at the Army post pool. We were up at dawn for swim team practice, and then we'd go back most days to play Marco Polo, practice our dives, listen to the lifeguards' whistles, and find out who could hold their breaths the longest underwater. So maybe it's not a toy, but summer days at the pool evoke such wonderful memories of summer.
Nice memories. Catch up on that conversation, listen back to anything on the show, and check out The Weekender this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.